As an unexpected sequel to the War on Murder, they became the guests of the Interrex, and from the start of their sojourn, voices had begun to call for war. Eidolon was one, but Eidolon was out of favour and easy to dismiss. Malagurst was another, and so too were Sidorei and Targost and Ralderon of the Blood Angels. Such men were not so easy to ignore. Sanguinius kept his counsel, waiting for the War Master's decision, understanding that Horus needed his brother Primarch's support. The argument ran as follows. The people of the Interrex are of our blood, and we descend from common ancestry. But they differ from us in fundamental ways, and these are so profound, that they are cause for legitimate war. They contradict the essential tenets of imperial culture as expressed by the Emperor, and such contradictions cannot be tolerated. For the while, Horus tolerated them well enough. Locan could understand why. The warriors of the Interrex were easy to admire. They were gracious and noble, and once the misunderstanding had been explained, utterly without hostility. It took a strange incident for Locan to learn the truth behind the War Master's thinking. It took place during the 9-week voyage from Murder to the nearest outpost world of the Interrex, the mingled ships of the expedition trailing the sleek vessels of the Interrex flotilla. The Mournival had come to Horus's private staterooms, and a row had erupted. Abaddon had been swayed by the arguments for war. He was convinced enough to face the War Master and not back down. Locan had watched in growing amazement as Abaddon and the War Master bellowed at each other. Locan had seen Abaddon wrathful before, but he had never seen the commander so ill-tempered. Horus's fury startled him a little, almost scared him. "You have no choice," Abaddon snarled. "Their ways are in opposition to ours. You must," Horus roared. "You are mournful, Abaddon. You advise and you counsel, and that is your place. Do not imagine you can tell me what to do." "I don't have to. You know what must be done. Get out, Ezekiel, before I look to find another first captain," Horus yelled. He glared at Abaddon, teeth clenched. Abaddon glowered back for a moment before storming from the chamber. The others stood in stunned silence. Horus turned, his head bowed.
"Torgadon," he said quietly.
"Lord, yes?"
"Go after him, please. Calm him down. Tell him if he craves my forgiveness in an hour or two, I might soften enough to hear him. But his voice had better not rise above a whisper."
Torgadon bowed and left the chamber immediately. Locan and Axemond glanced at one another, made an awkward salute, and turned to follow him out.
"Stay!" Horus growled.
They stopped in their tracks. When they turned back, they saw the War Master was shaking his head, wiping a hand across his mouth. A kind of smile informed his wide-set eyes. Horus sat down on one of the long, cushioned couches and waved to them with a casual flick of his hand.
"Sit, sit, take wine. Forgive my outburst. Half a Mournival is better than nothing."
They sat on the couch facing him. Horus took up a fresh cup and poured wine from the silver ewer.
"The wise one and the quiet one," he said.
Elokin wasn't sure which the War Master thought he was.
"Counsel me, then. You were both entirely too silent during that debate."
Axemond cleared his throat. "Ezekiel had a point," he began. He stiffened as he saw the War Master raise his eyebrows.
"Go on, little one."
"We prosecute this crusade according to certain doctrines. For 2 centuries we have done so. They are not arbitrary. They were given to us by the Emperor himself, and they have guided us since the start. We have never disobeyed them."
Axemond paused, then added,
"Before."
"You think this is disobedience?" Horus asked.
Axemond shrugged.
"What about you, Gaviel?" Horus asked. "Are you with Axemond on this?"
Locan looked back into the War Master's eyes.
"I know why we ought to make war upon the Interrex, sir," he said. "What interests me is why you think we shouldn't." "I'll tell you a thing," said Horus. "The first thing my father gave me was a simple astrological text. He noted my wonder in the stars and wished me to learn and understand."
He paused, Loken was always captivated whenever Horus referred to the Emperor as my father. It had happened a few times since Loken had been part of the Inner Circle, and on every occasion it had led to unguarded revelations.
There were zodiac charts in the text.
Horus took a sip of wine and smiled at the memory.
I learned them all, in one evening, all 20 signs. The next day, my father told me the zodiac signs were old and unreliable models, now that the explorative fleets had begun detailed cosmological mapping. He told me that the 20 signs in the heavens would one day be matched by 20 suns like me. Each sun would embody the character and notion of a particular zodiac group. He asked me which one I liked best.
What did you answer? Loken asked. Horus sat back and chuckled.
I told him I liked all the patterns they made. I told him I was glad to finally have names for the sparks of light in the sky. I told him I liked Leos naturally for his regal fury, and Scorpos for his armor and warlike blade. I told him that Turimak appealed to my sense of stubbornness, and Arbitos to my sense of fairness and balance.
The War Master shook his head sadly.
My father said he was surprised I had not picked another in particular. He showed me again the horseman with the bow, the dreadful Sagittari. In ancient times, he told me this was the greatest sign of all. The centaur, the hunter-warrior, had been beloved in the old ages. A rider upon a horse armed with a bow, the most potent martial instrument of its age, conquering all before it. Over time, myth had blended horseman and steed into one, the perfect synthesis of man and war machine. That is what you must master. One day you must command my armies as if they were an extension of your own person. At Ulinor, he gave me this.
Horus set down his cup and leaned forward to show them the weathered gold ring he wore on the smallest finger of his left hand. It was so eroded by age that the image was indistinct. Loken thought he could detect hooves, a man's arm, a bent bow.
It was made in Persia, the year before the Emperor was born. The dreadful Sagittari. This is you now, he said to me. My war master, my centaur, half man, half army, embedded in the legions of the Imperium. Ride on without me, and the armies will ride with you.
There was a long silence.
So you see, Horus smiled, I am predisposed to like the dreadful Sagittari.
His smile was infectious. Both Loken and Axemon nodded and laughed.
Now tell them the real reason, a voice said.
They turned. Sanguinius stood in an archway at the end of the chamber behind a veil of white silk. He had been listening. The Lord of Angels brushed the silk hanging aside and stepped into the stateroom.
Tell them the rest,
he sniggered.
Remember the start of my story, he asked. What the Emperor said to me about the stars. Make no mistake, and they will be ours. Those three words, make no mistake. I am Warmaster by the Emperor's decree. I cannot fail him. I cannot make mistakes. But since Ulinor, I have made two, and that is enough. For the responsibility of all expedition mistakes falls to me in the final count.
What mistakes? Asked Loken. Horus stroked his hand across his brow.
6319. How much blood was spilt there? Blood from misunderstanding? Poor dear Sejanus. That whole war, even that nightmare up on the mountains you had to endure. I could have handled it differently. 6319 could have been brought to compliance without bloodshed.
Horus shook his head.
Then there's murder, Horus continued. The Interrex left us warnings to stay away, and we ignored them. An embargoed world, an asylum for the creatures they had bested in war, and we walked straight in.
We weren't to know,
Sanguinius said.
We should have known, Horace snapped.
Therein lies the difference between our philosophy and that of the Interrex, Axemen said. We cannot endure the existence of a malign alien race. They subjugate it, but refrain from annihilating it. Instead, they exile it to a prison world. Tolerance is weakness. The Interrex is admirable, but it is forgiving in its dealings with Xenos breeds who deserve no quarter.
I will not make another rash decision, Horace stated flatly. I have made too many, and my war mastery is threatened by my mistakes. I will understand the Interrex and learn from it, and only then will I decide if it has strayed too far. They are a fine people. Perhaps we can learn from them for a change.
The first meeting between Imperium and Interrex had been formal and cautious. Envoys came aboard the Vengeful Spirit, along with a military escort. The envoys were uniformly handsome and lean, with piercing eyes. Their hair was dressed short, and intricate dermatoglyphics decorated either the left or right-hand side of their faces. They wore knee-length robes of a soft, pale blue cloth, under which they were dressed in close-fitting clothing. The soldiers were impressive. 50 of them had descended from their shuttle. Taller than the envoys, they were clad in metal armour of burnished silver and emerald green with chevrons of scarlet. The soldiers, variously gleaves or sagittars, Loken learned, were almost as tall as the Astartes, but with their far more slender build and more closely fitted armour, they seemed slight compared to the Imperial giants. Their weapons caused more remarks. Most of the soldiers had swords sheathed across their backs. Some, the gleaves, carried long, bladed metal spears with heavy ball counterweights on the base ends. The others, the sagittars, carried recurve bows wrought from some dark metal. The sagittars had sheaves of long, flightless darts laced to their right thighs.
Bows, Togaddon whispered. They come aboard carrying bows.
They're probably ceremonial, Axemen murmured.
Behind the slender soldiers came heavier forms. Shorter and far more thick-set, these men were similarly armoured, though in browns and golds. Loken supposed them to be heavy troopers, their bodies gene-bred for bulk and muscle, designed for close combat, but they carried no weapons. There were 20 of them, and they flanked 5 robotic creatures, slender, silver quadrupeds of intricate and elegant design, made to resemble the finest horses, except that they possessed no heads or necks. One of the flagship's embarkation decks had been entirely cleared for the ceremonial meeting. Imperial banners had been hung along the vault, and the whole of First Company assembled in full plate as an honour guard. The Astartes formed 2 unwavering blocks of white figures, their front rows a glossy black line of Justerin Terminators. In the aisle between the 2 formations, Horace stood with the Morneville, Malagurst, and other senior officials. The War Master and his lieutenants wore full armour and cloaks, though Horace's head was bare. They watched the heavy Interrex shuttle move ponderously down the lighted runway of the deck and settle on polished skids. Then hatch ramps in its prow opened and the envoys and their escorts disembarked. In total, there were over 100 of them. They came to a halt, with the envoys in a line at the front and the escort arranged in perfect symmetry behind. Horace gave a nod, and the men of First Company chested their weapons and bowed their heads in one unified motion. Horace himself stepped forward and walked alone down the aisle space, his cloak billowing behind him. He came face to face with what seemed to be the senior envoy, made the sign of the Aquila, and bowed.
I greet you on behalf of the Emperor of Mankind, and in the name of the Imperium.
On behalf of the Society of the Interrex, I accept your greetings and return them.
Thank you, said Horace.
The envoy bowed his head.
I am Diath Shen, Abracarius.
I am Horace, Warmaster.
Warmaster, he repeated.
The rank given to me personally by the Emperor of Mankind, so that I may act as his most senior lieutenant.
It is a robust title. Is your fleet a military undertaking?
It has a military component. Space is too dangerous for us to roam unarmed, but from the look of your fine soldiers, so does yours.
Shen pursed his lips. You laid assault to Urizarak with great aggression and in disregard to the advisory beacons we had positioned in the system. It would appear your military component is a considerable one.
We will discuss this in detail later. If an apology needs to be made, you will hear it directly from me. First, let me welcome you in peace.
Horus turned and made a signal. The entire company of Astartes and the plated officers locked off their weapons and removed their helms. Human faces, row after row. Openness, not hostility. In return, the warriors of the Interrex removed their visors, displaying clean, hard-eyed faces. Except for the heavy troops in brown and gold, when their helmets came off, they revealed faces that weren't human at all. They were called the Kinnibrak, an advanced, mature species. They had been an interstellar culture for over 15,000 years. They had already founded a strong, multi-world civilization in the local region of space, when the rest of humanity was only just feeling its way beyond the solar system in sublight vehicles. By the time the Interrex encountered them, their culture was aging and fading. A territorial war developed after initial contact and lasted for a century. Despite the Kinnibrak's superior technology, the humans of the Interrex were victorious, but in victory they did not annihilate the aliens. Rapprochement was achieved. Faced with options including further warfare and exile, the Kinnibrak elected to become client citizens of the expanding Interrex. For 3,000 years, the Interrex humans had successfully coexisted with the Kinnibrak. Conflict with the Kinnibrak was our first significant alien war, D'Arth Shen explained. He was seated with the other envoys in the War Master's audience chamber. All of the Mournival were present. It taught us about our place in the cosmos and certain values of compassion and empathy. The war made us realize that our very humanity, or at least our trenchant dependence on human traits, such as language, was an obstacle to mature relations with other species. No matter how sophisticated the means, Abaddon said, sometimes communication is not enough. In our experience, most Xenos types are willfully hostile. Communication and bargaining is not an option. The first captain, like many present, was uncomfortable. The entire Interrex party had been permitted to enter the audience chamber, and the Kinnibrak were attending at the far end. Abaddon kept glancing at them. They were hefty, simian things, with eyes so oddly sunken beneath big brow ridges that they were just sparks in shadows. Their flesh was blue-black and deeply creased, with fringes of russet hair surrounding the bases of their heavy, angular craniums. Mouth and nose was one organ, a trifold split at the end of their blunt jaw snouts, capable of peeling back, wet and pink, to sniff, or opening laterally to reveal a comb of small, sharp teeth. "This we have found ourselves," Shen agreed. "Sometimes we have encountered a species that has no wish to exchange with us, that approaches us with predatory or invasive intent. Sometimes conflict is the only option. Such was the case with the Megarachnid. They existed only to reproduce and develop territory. When we first met them, they infested 8 systems along the Shartiel edge of our provinces and threatened to invade and choke 2 of our populated worlds. We went to war to safeguard our own interests. We were victorious, but there was still no opportunity for rapprochement. We gathered all the Megarachnid remaining in captivity and transported them to Urizarak. The interdiction beacons were established to warn others away.
You did not consider exterminating them?
Malagurst asked. Shen shook his head.
What right have we to make another species extinct? In most cases, an understanding can be reached. The Megarachnid were an extreme example, where exile was the only humane option.
The approach you describe is a fascinating one, Horace said. I believe it is time for that apology. We misunderstood your methods and purpose on Urysorak. The Imperium apologizes for its transgression.
Meetings with the various Interrex envoys continued over a period of days. Sometimes the Interrex ships sent a mission to the vengeful spirit, sometimes an Imperial embassy crossed to their command ship and was entertained in glittering chambers of silver and glass. The envoys were hard to read. Their behaviour often seemed superior or condescending, as if they regarded the Imperials as crude and unsophisticated. But still, they were fascinated. However disappointing the reality, they could not bear to break off contact with their treasured ancestral past. Eventually, a summit was proposed, whereby the War Master and his entourage would travel to the nearest Interrex outpost world and conduct more detailed negotiations with higher representatives than the envoys. The War Master took advice from all quarters, though Loken was sure he had already made up his mind. Some, like Abaddon, counselled that links should be broken, and the Interrex held at abeyance until sufficient forces could be assembled to annex their territories. There were other matters at hand that urgently demanded the War Master's attention, matters that had been postponed for too long while he indulged in the war on murder. Loken began to see plainly what a burden the Emperor had placed on Horus's shoulders. He was expected to be all things, a commander of armies, a mastermind of compliance, a judge, a tactician, and the most delicate of diplomats. During the six-month war, more ships had arrived at high anchor above Murder. The rest of the 63rd expedition had translated under Varvarus's charge, 6319 having at last been left in the lonely hands of poor Rakris. One of Varvarus's ships had brought with it a delegation of Exector Tributi administrators from Terra. This was perhaps the most galling of all the voices baying for the War Master's attention. On the instruction of Malkador the Sigillite, the Exectors had been sent throughout the spreading territories of the Imperium. The delegation was led by a high administrix called Rathbone. He was a tall, slender, handsome man with red hair and pale, high-boned features, and his manner was exacting. It had been decreed that all expedition and crusade forces, all primarchs, all commanders, and all governors of compliant world systems should begin raising and collecting taxes from their subject planets in order to bolster the increasing fiscal demands of the expanding Imperium. All he insisted on talking about was the collection of tithes.
One world cannot support and maintain such a gigantic undertaking single-handed, he explained to the War Master in slightly over-shrill tones. We are masters of 1,000 worlds now, 1,000,000. The Imperium must begin to support itself.
Many worlds are barely in compliance, Horace said gently. They are recovering from the damage of war. Taxation is a blight they do not need.
The Emperor has insisted this be so.
Has he?
Malkador the Sigillite has impressed this upon me and all my rank. Tribute must be collected.
The world governors will find this too thankless a task, Malagus said. They are still legitimizing their rule. This is premature.
The Emperor has insisted this be so, he repeated.
That's the Emperor?
Loken asked. His comment made Horus smile broadly. Rathbone sniffed.
I'm not sure what you're implying, he said. This is my duty.
When he had retired from the room, Horus sat back alone amongst his inner circle.
I have often thought, he remarked, that it might be the Eldar who unseat us. Though fading, they are the most ingenious creatures. At other times, I have fancied that it would be the Greenskins. No end of numbers and no end of brute strength. But now, friends, I am certain it will be our own tax collectors who will do us in.
There was general laughter.
"I'm serious," he said. "This could trigger civil war in certain regions. At the very least, it could undermine the continued work of our expeditions. The executors need to be sidelined for the moment. They should be given terrific weights of material to pour through to determine precise tribute levels, world by world, and bombarded with copious additional intelligence concerning each world's status."
"It won't slow them down forever, Lord,"
Malaga said.
"Do your best," Horace said. "Delay Rathbone at least. Give me breathing space."
"I'll get to it,"
Malaga said. He rose and limped from the chamber. Horace turned to the assembled circle and sighed.
"So, it seems my wisest option is to confront the issue of taxation."
Sanguinius sniggered.
"I was not wrought to do that," Horace said.
"Then we should consider the Interrex, Lord," said Erebus.
Erebus, of the Word Bearer's Legion, the 17th, had joined them as part of the contingent brought by Varvarus. In his stone grey plate, inscribed with bas-relief legacies of his deeds, Erebus was a sombre figure. His rank was first chaplain, roughly equivalent to that of Abaddon or Eidolon. He was a senior commander of that legion, close to the Primarch Lorgar. The wolves had historically enjoyed a relationship with the bearers as close as the one they had formed with the Emperor's children. It was no coincidence that Horus counted Lorgar amongst his most intimate brothers. Erebus, who time had fashioned as much into a statesman as a warrior, had come to find the War Master at the behest of his legion. Evidently, he had a favour to crave, a request to make. One did not send Erebus except to broker terms. However, on his arrival, Erebus had understood immediately the pressure laid at Horus's door, the countless voices screaming for attention. He had shelved his reason for coming, wishing to add nothing to the War Master's already immense burden, and had instead acted as a solid counsel and adviser with no agenda of his own. For this, the Mournival had admired him greatly and welcomed him, like Raldorus, into the circle. Abaddon and Axamund had served alongside Erebus in numerous theatres. Torgadon knew him of old. All three spoke in nothing but the highest terms of First Chaplain Erebus.
"We should," Horus replied, "and my mind is made up. All these voices calling for my attention, pulling me this way and that. They can't disguise the fact that the Interrex is a significant new culture, occupying a significant region of space. We must deal with them directly. We cannot turn our attention elsewhere and expect them to stay put. If they are enemies, if they are against us, then they could pose a threat as great as the Greenskins. I will go to the summit and meet their leaders."
Zenobia was a provincial capital on the marches of Interrex territory. The envoys had been guarded in revelations of the precise size and extent of the Interrex, but their cultural holdings evidently occupied in excess of 30 systems, with the Heartworld some 40 weeks from the advancing edge of Imperial influence. Zenobia, a gateway world on the edge of Interrex space, was chosen as the site for the summit. It was a place of considerable wonder. Escorted from mass anchorage points in the orbit of the principal satellite, the War Master and his representatives were conducted to Zenobia Principis, a regal city on the shores of a wide sea. The city was set into the slopes of a wide bay, so that it shelved down the ramparts of the hills to sea level. The continental region behind it was sheathed in verdant rainforest, and this lush growth spilled down through the city too, so that the city structures, towers of pale grey stone and turrets of brass and silver, rose up out of the thick canopy like hilltop peaks. Where the grey towers and ornate campaniles rose above the forest, they were often capped in polished metal and adorned with high masts from which flags hung in the warm air. It was not a fortress city. There was little evidence of defences either on the ground or in local orbit. Horus was in no doubt that the place could protect itself if necessary. The Interrex did not wear its martial power as obviously as the Imperium, but its technology was not to be underestimated. The Imperial Party was over 500 strong and included Astartes officers, escort troops and iterators. Loken believed that the War Master was making an effort to establish a rather different impression than before. The envoys of the Interrex had seemed so disdainful of the expedition's military bias. Horus came to them now, surrounded as much by teachers as he was warriors. Loken was happy to see that his mentor, Sinderman, had also made the trip planetside. They were provided with excellent accommodation in the western part of the city, in a quarter known as the Extranus, where they were politely informed all strangers and visitors were reserved and hosted. Zenobia Principis was a place designed for diplomatic meetings, with the Extranus set aside to keep guests reserved in one place. Under the guided escort of Abracari, the Imperials were allowed beyond the shaded compound of the Extranus to visit the city. The city was home to buildings of exquisite design, and it was clear the Interrex possessed great skill in both stonemasonry and metalwork. Pavements abounded with gorgeous statuary and tranquil water fountains, but also with modernist public sculpture of light and sonics. Ancient lancet window slits were equipped with glass panels reactive to light and heat. Doors opened and closed via automatic body sensors. Interior light levels could be adjusted by a wave of the hand. The Imperium possessed many cities that were larger and grander and more cyclopean, but the Interrex city was every bit as refined and sophisticated as any conurbation in Imperial space, and it was merely a border settlement. On the day of their arrival, the Imperials were welcomed by a great parade, which culminated in their presentation to the senior royal officer of Zenobia, a general commander named Jeftar Nord. There were high-ranking civil officers in the Interrex party too, but they had decided to allow a military leader to oversee the summit. Just as Horus had diluted the martial composition of his embassy to impress the Interrex, so it had brought its military powers to the fore. The parade was complex and colourful. Gleaves and sagittars strode in long, uniform columns, their armour polished brightly and dressed with garlands of ribbons and leaves. Behind the human soldiery came the Kinnibrach auxiliaries, armoured and lumbering and glittering formations of robotic cavalry. The cavalry was made up of hundreds of the headless artificial horses that had featured in the envoy's honour guard. They were headless no longer. Sagittars and Gleaves had mounted the quadruped frames, seating themselves where the base of the neck would have been. Warrior armour and robot technology had fused smoothly, locking the riders in place, their legs folded into the breastbones of the steeds. They were centaurs now, man and device linked as one, myths given technological reality. The citizenry of Zenobia Principis came out in force for the parade, and cheered and sang and strewed the route of the procession with petals and strips of ribbon. The parade's destination was a building called the Hall of Devices, a place which apparently had some military significance to the Interrex. Old and of considerable size, the hall resembled a museum. Built into a steep section of the bay slopes, the hall enclosed many chambers that were more than two or three stories high. Plunging display vaults showed off assemblies of weapons, all suffused in the pale blue glow of the energy fields that secured them. The hall is both a museum of weapons and war devices and an armory, Jeftar Nord explained as he greeted them. Nord was a tall, noble creature, with complicated dermatoglyphics on the right side of his face. His eyes were the colour of soft gold, and he wore silver armour and a cloak of scalloped red metal links that made a sound like distant chimes when he moved. Though the Astartes had come armoured, the War Master had chosen to wear robes and furs rather than his battle plate. He showed great and courteous interest as Nord led them through the deep vaults, commenting on certain devices, remarking with delight when archaic weapons revealed a shared ancestry. "They are trying to impress us," Axeman murmured to his brothers. "A museum of weapons. They're as good as telling us they are so beyond war they've been able to retire it as a curiosity. They're mocking us."
"No one mocks me,"
Abaddon grunted. They were entering a chamber where, in the chilly blue field light, the artifacts were a great deal stranger than before.
"We hold the weapons of the Kinnibrach here," Nord said. "Indeed, we preserve here examples of the weapons used by many of the alien species we have encountered. The Kinnibrach have forsworn the bearing of arms, unless under such circumstances as we grant them said use in time of war. Kinnibrach technology is highly advanced, and many of their weapons are deemed too lethal to be left beyond securement."
Most of the Kinnibrach weapons on display didn't resemble weapons at all. Boxes, odd trinkets, rings, hoops. Nord clearly expected the Imperials to ask questions about the devices and betray their warmongering appetites, but Horus and his officers affected disinterest. In truth, they were uneasy in the society of the indentured alien. Only Cinderman expressed curiosity. A very few of the Kinnibrach weapons looked like weapons, long daggers and swords of exotic design.
"Surely, General Commander, a blade is just a blade," Cinderman asked politely. "How are these weapons too lethal to be left beyond securement?"
"They are tailored weapons," Nord replied. "Blades of sentient metal, crafted by the Kinnibrach metallurgists, a technique now utterly forbidden. We call them anathemes. When such a blade is selected for use against a specific target, it becomes that target's nemesis, utterly inimical to the person or being chosen."
"How?" Cinderman pressed.
Nord smiled. "The Kinnibrach have never been able to explain it to us. It is a factor of the forging process that defies technical evaluation."
"Like a curse," prompted Cinderman. "An enchantment?"
To Cinderman's surprise, Nord replied, "I suppose that is how you could describe it, Iterator."
The tour moved on. Cinderman drew close to Loken and whispered,
"I was joking about the curse, but he took me seriously. They are enjoying treating us as unsophisticated cousins, but I wonder if their superiority is misplaced. Do we detect a hint of pagan superstition?"
They all rose as the War Master entered the room. It was a large chamber in the Extraneous compound where the Imperials met for their regular briefings. Large shield-glass windows overlooked the tumbling terraces of the forested city and the glittering ocean beyond. Horus waited silently while six servitors finished their routine sweep for spyware and only spoke once they had activated the portable obscurement device in the corner of the room.
2 weeks without solid agreement, Horus said, nor even a mutually acceptable scheme of how to continue. They regard us with a mixture of curiosity and caution and hold us at arm's length. Any commentary?
We've exhausted all possibilities, Lord, Malaga said, to the extent that I fear we are wasting our time. They will admit to nothing but a willingness to open and pursue ambassadorial links with a view to trade and some cultural exchange. They will not be led on the subject of alliance.
Or compliance, Abaddon remarked quietly.
We will not have war here, Horus said. We cannot afford to open up a conflict on this front, not on the vast scale subduing the Interrex would demand, if they even need subduing.
Ezekiel has a valid point, said Erebus quietly. The Interrex, for good reason, I'm sure, have built a society that is too greatly at variance to the model of human culture that the Emperor has proclaimed. Unless they show a willingness to adapt, they must, by necessity, be regarded as enemies to our cause.
Perhaps the Emperor's model is too stringent, the War Master said flatly.
There was a pause. Several of those present glanced at each other in quiet unease.
Oh, come on! Sanguinius exclaimed, breaking the silence. Are you honestly nursing concerns that our War Master is contemplating defiance of the Emperor?
He laughed aloud at the very notion and forced a few smiles to surface. Abaddon was not smiling.
The Emperor enfranchised us to do his bidding and make known space safe for human habitation. His edicts are unequivocal. We must suffer not the alien, nor the uncontrolled psyker, safeguard against the darkness of the warp, and unify the dislocated pockets of mankind. That is our charge. Anything else is sacrilege against his wishes.
And one of his wishes, said Horus, was that I should be Warmaster. The Crusade was born out of the Age of Strife. Our ruthless approach of conquest and cleansing was formulated in a time when every alien form we met was hostile. Every fragment of humanity that was not with us was profoundly opposed to us. War was the only answer. There was no room for subtlety. But 2 centuries have passed, and different problems face us. The people of the Interrex are clearly not monsters, nor resolute foes. I believe that if the Emperor were here with us today, he would immediately embrace the need for adaptation. He would not want us to wantonly destroy that which there is no good reason to destroy. It is precisely to make such choices that he has placed his trust in me.
He looked round at them all.
He trusts me to make the decisions he would make. He trusts me to make no mistakes. I must be allowed the freedom to interpret policy on his behalf. I will not be forced into violence simply to satisfy some slavish expectation.
A chill evening had covered the tiers of the city, and under layers of foliage stirred by the ocean's breath, the walkways and pavements were lit with frosty white lamps. Loken's duty for that part of the night was as perimeter bodyguard. The commander was dining with Jeff Darnord and other worthies at the General Commander's palatial house. Horus had confided to the Morneville that he hoped to use the occasion to informally press Nord for some more substantial commitments, including the possibility that the Interrex might, at least in principle for now, recognise the Emperor as the true human authority. Such a suggestion had not yet been risked in formal talks, for the iterators had predicted it would be rejected out of hand. The Warmaster wanted to test the General Commander's feelings on the subject in an atmosphere where any offence could be smoothed over as conjecture. It was an uneasy time, well into the 3rd week of their increasingly fruitless visit. 2 days earlier, Primarch Sanguinius had finally taken his leave and returned to Imperial territory. Horus clearly hated to see him go, but it was a prudent move and one Sanguinius had chosen to make simply to buy his brother more time with the Interrex. Sanguinius was returning to deal directly with some of the matters most urgently requiring the Warmaster's attention, and thus mollify the many voices pleading for his immediate recall. Nord's house was a conspicuously vast structure near the centre of the city, 6 stories high. It overhung one of the grander civic tiers and was formed from a great black iron frame infilled with mosaics of varnished wood and coloured glass. The Interrex did not welcome armed foreigners abroad in their city, but a small detail of bodyguards was permitted for the Warmaster. Most of the Imperial contingent were sequestered in the Extraneous compound for the night. Torgadon and 10 hand-picked men from his company were inside the dining hall, acting as close guard, while Loken, with 10 men of his own, roamed the environs of the house. Loken had chosen 10th Company's 6th Squad, Walkure Tactical Squad, to stand duty with him. Through its veteran leader, Brother Sergeant Kyrus, he'd spread the men out around the entry areas of the hall and formulated a simple period of patrol. The house was quiet, the city too. There was the sound of the soft ocean breeze, the hissing of the overgrowth, and the splash and bell-tinkle of ornamental fountains. Loken strolled from chamber to chamber, from shadow to light. Most of the house's public spaces were lit from sources within the walls, so they played matrices of shade and colour across the interior, cast by the inset wall panels of rich wood and coloured gem glass. Occasionally, he encountered one of Walkure on a patrol loop, and exchanged a nod and a few quiet words.
Less frequently, he saw scurrying servants running courses to and from the closed dining hall, across the path of Nord's own sentries who said nothing but saluted to acknowledge him. Nord's house was a treasure trove of art, some of it mystifyingly alien to Loken's comprehension. The art was elegantly displayed in lit alcoves and on freestanding plinths with their own shimmering field protection. He understood some of it, portraits and busts, paintings and light sculptures, pictures of Interrex nobles and their families, studies of animals or wildflowers, mountain scenes, elaborate and ingenious models of unnamed worlds opened in mechanical cross-sections like the layers of an onion. In one lower hallway, in the eastern wing of the house, Loken came upon an artwork that especially arrested him. It was an old book, illuminated and held within its own box field. The lurid woodcut illuminations caught his eye first, the images of devils and spectres, angels and cherubs. He peered at it. A wave of his hand across the field's static charge turned the pages. He turned them right back to the front and read the title page in its bold woodblock. A Marvelous History of Evil, being a warning to mankind on the abuses of sorcery and the seduction of the demon. That has taken your eye, has it? Loken rose and turned. A royal officer of the Interrex stood nearby, watching him. Loken knew the man, one of Nord's subordinate commanders, by the name of Mithras Tull. What he didn't know was how Tull had managed to come up on him without Loken noticing.
"It is a curious thing, Commander," he said.
Tull smiled. He came forward and brushed the field with his metal-sleeved fingers to flip the pages. "My lord Jephthah adores this book. It was composed during the early years of our history, before the Interrex was properly founded. A treatise against the practice of sorcery."
"Nord adores it," Loken asked.
"As a... what was your word again? A curiosity." It's such a woe-begotten Dark Age piece," Tull continued. "So doomy and apocalyptic. Imagine men voyaging out into the stars equipped with great and wonderful technologies and fearing the dark so much they have to compose treatises on demons."
"Demons?"
"Indeed. This warns against the arts by which a man might transform into a demon and prey upon his own kind. Some became demons and turned upon their own."
"So, you regard it as a joke?"
Tull shrugged. "Not a joke, Captain. Just an old-fashioned alarmist approach. The Interrex is a mature society. We understand the threat of chaos well enough."
"Chaos?"
Tull frowned. "You say the word like you've never heard it before."
"I know the word. You say it like it has a specific connotation."
"Well, of course it has," Tull said. "No star-faring race in the cosmos can operate without understanding the nature of chaos. We thank the Eldar for teaching us the rudiments of it, but we would have recognized it soon enough without their help. Surely one can't use the Immaterium for any length of time without coming to terms with chaos as a..." His voice trailed off into a laugh.
"You don't know, do you?"
"Don't know what?"
Loken snapped. Tull stopped laughing and stared into Loken's face. "Chaos is the damnation of all mankind. Chaos will outlive us and dance on our ashes. All we can do is to recognize its menace and keep it at bay for as long as we persist."
"Not enough," said Loken.
Tull shook his head sadly. "We were so wrong," he said.
"About what?"
"About you. About the Imperium. I must go to Nord at once and explain this to him. If only the substance of this had come out earlier."
"Explain it to me first, and now, here."
Tull gazed at Loken for a long, silent moment, as if judging his options. Finally he shrugged and said, "Chaos is a primal force of the cosmos. It resides within what you call the warp. It is a source of the most complete corruption and evil. It is the greatest enemy of mankind because it destroys from within. It is not like a hostile alien form to be defeated or expunged. It spreads like a disease. It is at the root of all sorcery and magic. It is the reason we have kept you at arm's length. You have to understand that when we first made contact, we were overjoyed. At last, contact with our lost kin after so many generations. It was a dream we had all cherished, but we knew we had to be careful. In the ages since we last had contact, things might have changed. There was no guarantee that while the men of the Interrex remained pure, the men of...
We are not.
Let me finish. Chaos, when it manifests, is brutal, rapacious, warlike. It is a force of unquenchable destruction. So the Elder have taught us, and the Kinnibrach, and so the pure men of the Interrex have stood to check chaos wherever it rears its warlike visage. Tell me, Captain, how warlike do you appear? Vast and bulky, bred for battle, driven to destroy, led by a man you happily title Warmaster. The term reeks of chaos. We yearn to embrace you, to join with you, to stand shoulder to shoulder with you, but we fear you. You resemble the enemy we have been raised from birth to anticipate, the all-conquering, unrelenting demon of chaos.
That is not us, said Loken aghast.
Tull nodded eagerly. I know it. I see it now. Truly, there is no taint in you.
I'll try not to be offended.
Tull laughed and clasped his hands around Loken's right fist. No need. We can show you the dangers to watch for. We can be brothers and... He paused suddenly and took his hands away.
What is it? Loken asked.
Tull was listening to his comm relay. His face darkened. Understood, he said to his collar mic. He looked back at Loken. Security lockdown. I'm sorry this seems very blunt after what we've just been saying, but would you surrender your weapons to me?
My weapons?
Yes, Captain.
I'm sorry, I can't do that. Not while my commander is in the building.
Tull cleared his throat and fitted his visor plate to his armor. He reached out and carefully took hold of his spear. Captain Loken, he said, I demand you turn your weapons over to me at this time.
Loken took a step back. For what reason?
I don't have to give a reason. I'm officer of the watch. Hand over your weapons.
Loken clamped his own helm in place. The visor screens were alarmingly blank. He checked subvox and security channels, trying to reach any of the bodyguard detail. His suit systems were being comprehensively blocked. Are you damping me? He asked.
City systems are damping you. Hand me your sidearm.
I'm afraid I can't. My priority is to safeguard my commander.
Tull shook his armored head. Oh, you're very clever. You almost had me believing you were innocent.
Tull, I don't know what's going on.
Don't pretend. The Hall of Devices is burning. You've made your move. Now the Interrex replies.
Tull, Loken warned, placing his hand firmly on the pommel of his blade. Don't make me fight you.
With a snarl of disappointed rage, Tull swung his spear at Loken. The Interrex officer moved with astounding speed. Even with his hand on his blade, Loken had no time to draw it. He managed to snatch up his plated arms to fend off the blow, and the two that followed it. The lightweight armor of the Interrex soldiery seemed to facilitate the most dazzling motion and dexterity, perhaps even augmenting the user's natural abilities. Tull's attack was fluent and professional, slicing in blows with a long spear blade designed to force Loken back and down into submission. The microfine edge of the blade hacked several deep gouges into Loken's plating.
Tull, stop!
Surrender to me now!
Loken had no wish to fight, and scarcely any clue as to what had turned Tull so suddenly and completely, but he had no intention of surrendering. The Warmaster was on sight, exposed.
Loken focused. He swung out, met the next blow, and smashed the blade aside with the ball of his fist.
Tull travelled with the recoil, using the momentum to drive a thrust at Loken's chest.
It never landed. Logan caught the spear at the base of the blade with his left hand and stopped it dead. Before Tull could pull free, Logan punched with his right fist against the flat of the blade and broke the entire blade tip off the spear. It spun away, end over end. Tull rallied and rotated the broken weapon to drive the weighted base end at Logan like a long club. Logan guarded off two heavy blows with the edges of his gauntlets. Tull twisted his grip, and the spear suddenly became charged with dancing blue sparks of electrical charge. He slammed the crackling ball at Logan again, and there was a loud bang. The discharging force of the spear was so powerful that Logan was thrown bodily across the chamber. He landed on the polished floor and slid a few meters. He tasted blood in his mouth and felt the brief, quickly occluded pain of serious bruising to his torso. Logan scissored his back and legs and sprang up to his feet as Tull closed in. Now he brought his sword out. In the multicolored light, the white steel blade of his combat sword shone like a spike of ice in his fist. He offered Tull no opportunity to renew the bout as aggressor. Logan launched forward at the charging man and swung hammer blows with his sword. Tull recoiled, forced to use the remains of the spear as a parrying tool, the imperial blade biting chips out of its haft. Tull leapt back and drew his own sword over his shoulder from the scabbard on his back. He clutched the long silver sword in his right hand and the broken spear in his left. When he came in again, he was swinging blows with both. Logan predicted and matched all of the strikes. His blade flicked left and right, spinning the spear back and parrying the sword with two loud chimes of metal. He forced his way into Tull's bodyline guard and pressed his sword aside long enough to shoulder barge the royal officer in the chest. Tull staggered back. Logan gave him no respite. He swung again and tore the spear out of Tull's left hand. It bounced across the floor, sparking and firing. Then they closed, blade on blade. The exchange was furious. Logan had no doubts about his own ability. He'd been tested too many times of late and not found wanting. But Tull was evidently a master swordsman and had learned his art via some entirely different school of bladesmanship. There was no common language in their fight, no shared basis of technique. It was almost enjoyable. Logan believed Lucius would have reveled in such a match, so many new techniques to delight at. But it was wasting time. Logan parried Tull's next quicksilver slice, captured his right wrist firmly in his left hand, and struck off Tull's sword arm at the elbow with a neat and deliberate chop. Tull rocked backwards, blood venting from his stump. Logan tossed the sword and severed limb aside. He grabbed Tull by the face and was about to perform the mercy stroke, then thought better of it. He smashed Tull in the side of the head with his sword instead, using the flat. Tull went flying. His body cartwheeled clumsily across the floor and came to rest against the foot of one of the display plinths. "This is Logan," Logan yelled in his link. Nothing but dead patterns and static. Switching his blade to his left hand, he drew his bolter and ran forward. He'd gone three steps when two sagittars bounded into the chamber, bows already drawn to fire. "Drop the bows," he ordered via his helmet speakers. The bolter in his hand told them not to argue. They threw aside the bows and shafts with a clatter. Logan nodded his head at Tull, his gun still covering them both. "I've no wish to see him die," he said. "Bind his arm quickly before he bleeds out." They wavered and then ran to Tull's side. When they looked up again, Logan had gone. He ran down a hallway into an adjoining colonnade, hearing what was certainly bolter fire in the distance. Another sagittar appeared ahead and fired what seemed like a laser bolt at him. The shot went wide past his left shoulder. Logan aimed his bolter and put the warrior on his back, hard. No room for compassion now. Two more Interrex soldiers came into view. Logan, still running, shot them both before they could react. The force of his bolts, both torso shots, threw the soldiers back against the wall, where they slithered to the ground. He heard footsteps and turned. It was Kyrus and one of his men, Altrents. Both had weapons drawn. "What the hell's happening, Captain?" Kyrus yelled. "With me," Logan demanded. "Where's the rest of the detail?" "I have no idea," Kyrus complained. "The Vox is dead."
"We're being damped," Altrents added.
"Priority is the War Master," Logan assured them. "Follow me and..."
More flashes, like laser fire. Projectiles moving so fast they were just lines of light, zipped down the colonnade, faster than Loken could track. Altrens dropped onto his knees with a heavy clang, transfixed by two flightless arrows that had cut clean through his Mark IV plate. Clean through. Loken could still remember Torgadon's amusement and Axemon's assurance. They're probably ceremonial. Altrens fell on his face. He was dead, and there was no time, and no apothecary to make his death fruitful. Further shafts flashed by. Loken felt an impact. Kairos staggered as a Sagittar's dart punched entirely through his torso and embedded itself in the wall behind him.
"Kairos! Keep on, Captain!" Kairos drawled in pain. "Too clean a shot. I'll heal."
Kairos rose and opened up with his storm bolter, firing an auto. He hosed the colonnade ahead of them, and Loken saw three Sagittars crumble and explode under the thunderous pummel of the weapon. Together, they kicked their way into the main dining hall. The room was chaotic. Torgadon and the rest of his detail were covering the War Master as they led him towards the south exit. There was no sign of Nord, but Interrex soldiers were firing at Torgadon's group from a doorway on the far side of the chamber. Bolter fire lit up the air. Several bodies, including that of a Lunar Wolf, lay twisted amongst the overturned chairs and banquet tables. Loken and Kairos trained their fire on the far doorway.
"Taric! Good to see you, Garvey. What the hell is this?"
"A mistake," Horus roared, his voice cracking with despair. "This is wrong."
Brilliant shafts of light stung into the wall alongside them. Sagittar darts sliced through the smoky air. One of Torgadon's men buckled and fell, a dart speared through his helm.
"Mistake or not, we have to get clear. Now!" Loken yelled.
The fight to extricate themselves from Nord's house lasted 10 furious minutes. Loken and Kairos led the rearguard with the brothers Torgadon had appointed to them, while Torgadon himself ferried the War Master out through the basement loading docks onto the street. Twice Horus insisted on going back in, not wanting to leave anyone, especially not Loken behind. Somehow, using words Torgadon never shared with Loken, Torgadon persuaded him otherwise. By the time they had come out into the street, the remainder of Loken's outer guard had formed up with them, adding to the armor wall around the War Master, all except Jaeldun, whose fate they never learned. Loken dragged Kairos the entire way. They were out into the city evening, the dark canopy hissing in the breeze over their heads. In the distance, a ruddy glow backlit the clouds, spilling up from a building in the lower depths of the tiered city. Sirens wailed around them.
"I'm all right," Kairos said, though it was clear he was having trouble standing. "Close that one, Captain."
He reached up and plucked out a Sagittar shaft that had struck through Loken's right shoulder plate, the impact he'd felt in the colonnade.
"We have to get the War Master to safety," Torgadon said. "To the Extraneus."
Loken nodded. "We have to."
"No,"
said a voice. They looked round. Horus stood beside them. His face was sidelit by the burning dock. His wide-set eyes were fierce. He had dressed for dinner that night, not for war. It was clear from his manner that he itched for armor plate and a good sword.
"With respect, sir," Torgadon said, "you are our responsibility." "No," Horus said again. "Protect me by all means, but I will not go quietly. Some terrible mistake has been made tonight. All we have worked for is overthrown."
"We must get you out alive," Torgadon said.
"Taric's right, Lord," Loken added. "This is not a situation that..." "Enough," Horus said.
He looked up at the sighing black branches above them.
"What has gone so wrong? Nord took such great and sudden offence. He said we had transgressed."
"I spoke with a man," Loken said. "Just when things turned sour, he was telling me of chaos."
"What?"
"Of chaos, and how it is our greatest common foe. He feared it was in us. He said that is why they had been so careful with us, because they feared we had brought chaos with us." "What did he mean?"
Horus looked at Loken. "He meant Jubal. He meant the Whisperheads. He meant the warp. Have you brought the warp here, Gavia Loken?"
"No, sir."
"Then the fault is within them. Now we know the truth."
Loken shook his head. "I don't think that's what was meant. I think these people despise chaos, the warp, as much as we do.
I think they only fear it in us. Something has proved that fear right.
Like what?
Togaden snapped. Tull said the Hall of Devices was on fire.
Horace nodded. This is what they accused us of. Weapons were stolen.
What weapons, sir? Logan asked.
Horace shook his head. Nod didn't say. He was too busy accusing me over the dinner table. That's where we should go now.
The hall was on fire. Bursting fields exploded through the lower depths and cascaded flames up into the higher galleries. A curator, blackened by smoke, limped out to greet them.
Have you not sinned enough? He asked venomously.
What is it you think we have done? Horace asked.
Petty murder. The hall is burning. You could have asked to know of the anathema. You had no need to kill to win it.
Horace shook his head.
We have done nothing.
The curator laughed, then fell.
Help him,
Horace said. Scads of ash were falling on them, drizzling from a choking black sky. The blaze had spread to the oversweeping forest, and the street was flame-lit. There was a rank smell of burning vegetation. On lower street tiers, hundreds of figures gathered, looking up at the fire. A great panic, a horror, was spreading through Zenobia Principis.
They feared us from the start, the War Master said. Now they will believe they were right to do so.
Interrex formations were approaching. Loken heard hooves clattering on the flagstones and saw the shapes of mounted sagittars bobbing black against the fires. Darts, like bright tears, began to drizzle through the night. They struck the ground and the walls nearby.
My lord, no more delays, Togaden urged. Gleaves were massing too, their moving spears, black stalks against the orange glow. Sparks flew up like lost prayers into the sky.
Hold! Horace bellowed at the advancing soldiers. In the name of the Emperor of Mankind, I demand to speak to Nod. Fetch him now!
The only reply was another flurry of shafts. The lunar wolf beside Togaden fell dead, and another staggered back, wounded. An arrow had embedded itself in the War Master's left arm. Without wincing, he dragged it out and watched his blood spatter the flagstones at his feet. He walked to the fallen Astartes, bent down, and gathered up the man's bolter and sword.
Their mistake, he said to Loken and Torgadon, not ours. If they're going to fear us, let us give them good reason.
He raised his sword in his fist.
For the Emperor, he yelled.
Lupercal, Lupercal, answered the handful of warriors around him. They met the charging sagittars head-on, bolter fire strobing the narrow street, robot steeds shattered and tumbled, men falling from them, arms spread wide. Horus was already moving to meet them, ripping his sword into steel flanks and armoured chests. His first blow knocked a man-horse clear into the air, crashing it back over onto the ranks behind it.
Lupercal!
Loken yelled, coming to the War Master's right side, and swinging his sword double-handed. Torgadon covered the left, striking down a trio of gleaves, then using a lance taken from one of them to smite the pack that followed. Interrex soldiers, some screaming, were forced back down the steps or toppled over the stone railing of the street to plunge onto the tier beneath. Of all the battles Loken had fought at his commander's side, that was the fiercest, the saddest, the most vicious. Teeth bared in the firelight, swinging his blade at the foe on all sides, Horace seemed more noble than Loken had ever known. He would remember that moment years later when fate had played its cruel trick and sense had turned upside down. He would remember Horace in that narrow, firelit street, defining the honour and unyielding courage of the Imperium of Man. There should have been frescoes painted, poems written, symphonies composed, all to celebrate that instant when Horus made his most absolute statement of devotion to the throne and to his father. There would be none. The hateful future swallowed up such possibilities, swallowed the memories too, until the very fact of that nobility became impossible to believe. The enemy warriors choked the street, driving the War Master and his remaining bodyguards into a tight ring, a last stand. It was oddly, as he had imagined it, that night in the garden making his oath. Some great last stand against an unknown foe fighting at Horus's side.
He was covered in blood, his suit dented in 100 places. He did not falter. Through the smoke above, Loken glimpsed a moon, a small moon glowing in the corner of the alien sky. Appropriately, it was reflected in the glimmering mirror of ocean out in the bay.
Lupercal! Screamed Loken.
The battle of Zenobia Principis lasted until dawn and engulfed much of the city. At the first sign of commotion, unable to establish contact with either the War Master or the fleet, Abaddon and Axemund had mobilized the two companies of Lunar Wolves garrisoned at the Extraneus. In the streets surrounding the compound area, the people of the Interrex got their first taste of the power of the Imperial Astartes. In the years to come, they would experience a good deal more. Abaddon was in wrathful mood, so much so that Axemon had to rein him back on several occasions. It was Axemon's units that first reached the Warmaster on the upper tier near the Hall of Devices, and fought a route to him through Nord's army. Abaddon's forces had struck at several of the city's control stations and restored communications. The fleet was already moving in response to the apparent threat to the Warmaster and the Imperial parties on the ground. With communications restored, a full-scale extraction was coordinated, drawing all Imperial personnel from the Extraneus and from fighting zones in the streets. Horus sent one final communique to the Interrex. He expected no response and received none. Far too much blood had been spilled, and destruction wrought for relations to be soothed by diplomacy. Nevertheless, Horus expressed his bitter regret at the turn of events, lamented the Interrex for acting with such a heavy hand, and repeated once again his unequivocal denial that the Imperium had committed any of the crimes of which it stood accused. When the ships of the expedition returned to Imperial space some weeks later, the War Master had a decree proclaimed. He told the Morneville that, upon reflection, he had reconsidered the importance of defining his role and the relationship of the 16th Legion to that role. Henceforth, the Lunar Wolves would be known as the Sons of Horus. Air hummed down rusting ducts and flues. Darkness pooled in the belly vaults of the vengeful spirit, in the bilges where even the lowliest ratings and proto-servitors seldom strayed. Only vermin lived here, gnawing a putrid existence in the bowels of the ancient ship. By the light of a single candle, he held the strange blade up and watched how the glow coruscated off its edge. The blade was rippled along its length, grey like napped flint, and caught the light with a glitter like diamond. A fine thing, a beautiful thing, a cosmos-changing thing. He could feel the promise within it breathing, the promise and the curse. Slowly, Erebus lowered the anathema, placed it in its casket, and closed the lid. Horus Rising was written by Dan Abnett and read by Martin Ellis. It was produced by Heavy Entertainment for Black Library. This work is copyrighted by Games Workshop Limited 2010. All rights reserved.